Hey, everybody.
Hi, Nick.
Welcome. We're gonna have ourselves another night of the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. And in just a second, I am gonna put a link to it because I know that I don't think it's in the chant book. And so I've got a PowerPoint that I'll pull up, and then when we start talking sort of line by line, you could use the PowerPoint. But if you are interested in the poem itself, just put a link in the chat to the poem. It's by Sherto, who's a Cham master from 900, and it was like around 900, and we'll talk just a little bit about it. Thanks everybody for coming. I think Jim did a couple of like sangha announcements. I'm not sure if there's anything else we need. Let's see. I'm also doing a Thursday night group where we talk about Sandokai, the harmony of difference and sameness, which is also by Sherto. It's a different poem. It's got a very different flavor, but it's essentially about the same thing, which is kind of fun. And so we do that on Thursday nights. That starts a half an hour later than these do. So I think that's 7:30 Pacific and 10:30 Eastern. So if anybody's interested in that, and then I think next week, Tuesday, I think January takes over and we do householder koans. Is that correct? All right. I'm excited about that. I got that one from my bookstore a week or two ago, and it looks like a really interesting book. So I've already kind of flipped through a couple of them. So I would recommend anybody to go out and grab it. Also, as a recommendation for getting the book, I do remember Jinryu saying that when Domio comes back in August, I think she's planning on doing at least maybe four from that book. So we will continue, I think, with the Householder Koans book after July. Is that correct, Jinryu?
That's correct.
Perfect. So if that like maybe pushes you over the edge to go buy it, definitely, I think that would be a cool thing.
Hey, Nick.
Yes.
So, is there a sit with the Thursday night? Haven't been able to make it yet, but is
Yes,
there?
the Thursday night is 30 minutes of sit and then an hour of discussion. And so we kind of cut out some of the, well, we just kind of cut out some stuff to make it a little bit shorter. So it's only an hour and a half in total. So there's not kind of like a long chanting. We do chant the Sandokai at the beginning, but that kind of cuts into the sit. And then we kind of get right into the talk. We don't sangha visit either. So yeah, it's just an hour and a half on Thursdays. I feel like that's it for discussion things. What we'll do is I'll put the poem up. I'll read the poem, and then we'll get into some business about talking to it. So or talking through it. Let's see if I can. I gotta share my screen. Oh, there's a share screen button. Oh no. The host, who is maybe Jim, can you Aaron, can you enable participant screen sharing?
No, can I?
I don't know if you know.
How would one do this?
You can just make him a co-host. You know how to do that?
Oh, ooh.
That's fair. Yeah, I will do that, Mick. Yeah.
Feel important now.
There you go.
Oh, I just had a bunch of stuff pop up, so I am now a ghost. Okay, perfect. All right. So we are going to read the poem. If you want to open up the link, we're not necessarily going to chant it, but we'll just read it to kind of soak it in, and then we'll start talking about some of the particular lines. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared, and now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. A great vehicle bodhisattva trusts without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present. Not dwelling north or south, east or west, firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats, trying to entice guests? Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers, be familiar with their instruction, bind grasses to build a hut, and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk, innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from the skin bag here and now. I want to take just a second. Marv sent me an email maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago that was just wonderful. He mentioned that Chinese landscape painting actually has a lot of, often has the grass hut as an image in it. And he has sent me a couple of pictures that I think are just absolutely wonderful. Marv, I do not mean to put you on the spot, and I should have asked you about this earlier, but I don't know if you want to talk about either of these two. I just know that they look wonderful.
Thank you, Mick. Do you want to show the second one? Let's see which shows up better on the screen.
Sure.
That one probably doesn't show up as well, but let's start with that one. Notice the pines over the grass hut. The pine is a representation of the sage in the hut. Anyway, I just wanted to mention there's a long history and huge importance that theme of the sage taking refuge in nature and using a grass roof hut instead of a tile roof hut. And it sounds very Taoist because of the learning from nature, and they're often shown gazing out at nature from their window. That window is also mentioned in the poem. But it actually starts sort of in a composite way. When the so-called first emperor, the Qin dynasty, persecuted Confucian sages, killed many of them, drove others into the mountains where they stayed until 2 decades later, the dynasty was overthrown and the Han dynasty came in with Confucian-oriented government. So they returned and became bureaucrats again. So it kind of mixes Confucianism and Taoism, but it has tended to be most associated with the Taoist learning from nature. And the Buddhists, as you know, especially Zen Buddhists, took up a lot of Taoist imagery in both verbally and visually. And that sort of explains part of why Chouteau used the image in, not only the image, but actually built himself a grass roof hut at his monastery. That's really all I had to say.
Thank you. That was wonderful, Mar. This is the second one. It's also got some pines in it and a grass roof. It's just okay. I really enjoyed that. Thank you. I do want to take a second. We're going to try to involve everybody. We're going to kind of like try to involve everybody at stages. I'm just going to kind of put my little discussion norms thing back up. I know everybody here, this is a wonderful space, and I love it for that. And I want everyone to know that that it's a safe space, and I want everyone to feel that safety as we share with each other, just sort of to take a moment to reflect on these and to remember that even though you might feel safe and okay in the space, there are lots of other people that might feel more vulnerable. And it's important for all of us to cultivate that feeling of safety for everybody. And I think we always do follow these norms. I just want to make sure that everybody knows that we do follow them and we respect them. And I will remind everybody about the recording thing, because I always do. If you do want to share something that you don't necessarily want to be recorded, you just send me a message and we can stop the recording for that portion of the share. Okay. Well, last time we didn't get very far, which I think is wonderful. I do not expect that we will get through sort of like piece by piece the whole poem. That's not really the goal. I'd rather us just kind of spend some time talking about the lines and sort of covering them in the same way that we do. One of the things that I want to, I have kind of not used it as much as I would have wanted to, but there's actually a book that I think is pretty new. It's called Inside the Grass Hut, Living Chouteau's Classic Poem by a guy named Ben Connolly. And he wrote a book, and the whole book is about this poem. And I've used it kind of sparingly, but it's a wonderful book. If anybody feels like they have found a connection to this poem, I would highly recommend it. He wrote something in there that I wanted to share to kind of start things off, because I find that this is such a great encapsulation of the things that I find interesting about Zen. And he was talking about a particular teaching, but I think it can apply to most any teachings. And he said this: the purpose of the teaching is not to present the truth, but to blow your mind. Blow out the cobwebs and stale air. It invites you to come out of the attic of your mind's endless story and step into the fresh air of the mountainside and find an old guy sitting next to a grass hut in a patch of sun. And most of my interaction with what I would call maybe like Zen primary texts, right? So it's not the Norman Fisher books or the Diane Rossetto books or those sorts of things, but the sort of like teachings and the sutras and the chants and the poems, none of them really make any sense. And they're all like really disorienting at the outset. And then you kind of like read into them and you figure out a little more context and you just find them like very rich and disorienting still. And I think that quote kind of like put it all into perspective for me, because that's kind of the whole point, is for you to get disoriented and then find things that you can orient yourself with that genuinely matter, right? You want to blow out the cobwebs in the attic of your mind so that you can come into the fresh air and see what's there to be seen. It actually reminds me of an image that in Guo Gu's book, Silent Illumination, in the very beginning of the book, he has a metaphor that he uses to say that our mind is like a room full of furniture, and we spend most of our time focusing on the furniture so hard that we forget that we're in this very spacious and airy, well-lit room. And it's always there. We just need to spend time focusing on it and not get caught up in the furniture and the clutter that's inside the room. And the longer we sit, the longer we're able to move furniture out of the room and be continually reminded of its openness and light. And I thought that was beautiful. And that to me is what this poem in particular does. And that's what I love Sherdow for, is he kind of knocks you around enough to kind of, I don't know, jar something loose maybe. So where we last left off, we got through the first two stanzas, and now we're on, though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. I like this image of the small hut, and yet it includes the entire world. I think that this image in particular, to me, last week we had sort of talked about how the grass hut can be a metaphor for lots of different things. It can be a metaphor for zazen, or our practice, or living our practice, or ourselves. And I think the idea of this grass hut being ourselves, right? There is this sense of small self that we have. Shinri Suzuki likes to call it the small mind. But then there's also big mind that's there, and it's always there. And so our own grass hut, if we take it to be us, it's small, but it includes the entire world. And in 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms in their nature. A great vehicle bodhisattva trusts without doubt. And I wanted to stop on this one, because I want to ask some people some things, because this one I'm very curious about. So a great vehicle is a way of translating Mahayana. And so there's the Mahayana practice, which is, you know, our tradition is a part of that. And then there's the Hinayana, which is more of like a pejorative use that nobody really identifies as it. But so this great vehicle bodhisattva trusts without doubt. And what I want everybody to think about for a minute, and then we'll go around and see if anybody wants to share, is if Sherdow is calling us to a way of practicing, what is it that we're supposed to trust without doubt? What in our practice do we trust without doubt? What do we put our faith in our practice? And I'll speak to this for a little bit. And I think I've told this story before, so I'm gonna apologize, because I think people have probably heard it maybe even in the last 2 weeks. But my path to Buddhism is weird, and it involves a bunch of tangents. But I remember very clearly when I was in high school, I was a young man, and we read Siddhartha, which is like a fairly common, I guess, for high school students to read. But and so I started experimenting with Buddhism and reading some things that I had found, a couple of books, and meditating. And I remember very clearly this image that I kind of saw while I was meditating, that I guess I would now call interbeing, or maybe like Indira's net, where we're all sort of fundamentally connected. And I saw it and felt it in a way that was visceral and real. And a few years, and so I stuck with Buddhism for a while after that, but I didn't really have a structure to my practice. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a sangha. This was very early days of the internet, so I didn't necessarily know where to go for practice resources, and so I fell out of practice. But recently I started meditating again for like a stress relief thing. You know, I read some books on like mindfulness, and after sitting for a while, it became very clear to me, like in a way that transcends my ability to explain it, that I just know of the interconnectedness of all beings. I feel it, not all the time, but I can feel it, and that is something that I trust without doubt. It is something that that it's even weird to call it faith, because I just know it to be true. I'm not even sure if I would classify that as faith, but it feels like a direct experience of that. And so I wanted to ask what anyone else in their practice trusts without doubt. And if you want to raise a hand, you can raise a hand. I think we're small enough to where you can just sort of mute if you'd like to. I'd also like to say, if there's nothing that you trust without doubt, that's also valid too. Joan, I think I saw a hand up.
Yeah, I'm going to say what I trust without doubt is what comes up for me, and that might sound funny, but I say that because, oh, sorry, let me turn.
Kind of timing there.
I say that because I didn't used to trust what came up for me. In addition, I was totally very out of touch with it. So that is actually a quite comforting thing for me now, just to trust what I'm feeling and just the reality of my own experience.
Yeah.
So
that's wonderful. It's so interesting how the human capacity to kind of resist what we know is true on some level, and you can almost feel your body like fighting it like magnets that are like north and north of a magnet. They get really close, and then the closer they get, the harder they push away, the way that we kind of resist our own feelings.
Kind of like, it's over there, I'm not even going to look at it, you know, it just ignoring it.
I like that. That's good.
Yeah. So
thank you, Joan.
Yeah.
Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I'm a very new practitioner, and when I read that line, that sounded to me like what I've been coming back to, which is a lot of the time I think or know that I'm not doing it right, Zazen practice in general, or even the type of mindfulness that Domyo talks about. And and that to trust in the practice itself, to trust in just to keep doing it, just without an expectation that I'll get it right. And without just to keep, just to do it again, just to do it. And that's for me what I'm trusting right now.
Yeah. That was wonderful. Thank you. It's interesting when I started practicing too, and even now, like I'm not sure I could really tell you what draws me to sit. I don't really know. It's so fascinating to me the way that I just like, I don't know. I'm going to go sit. I find it not helpful in sort of like a traditional sense. Like, I don't feel like a better person because I sat, but I don't know, just something about it. It's strange the way it draws me in. Thank you for sharing, Kiran. Ruth Ann, did you want to say something?
Sorry, I guess I was on unmuted, so I didn't want to enter the flow. But for me, it's the consistency of what the lineage has, and also the challenge. I mean, the line, you know, proper sitting requires your full attention. And it's not, Sazen is not the definition of what a lot of people call meditating. And meditating is good, but it's not Sazen. So, knowing the difference to me is a challenge, living the difference. And it's like, it's part of my day whenever I choose or do sitting.
Yeah.
So it's like, my day is not complete in a way because something was missing. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you mentioned the lineage, Ruth Ann. I like, that's one of the things that I really enjoy about the practice. And one of the things that made practice feel a little more real to me was I started doing some chants and doing the chanting service on Sundays, which is really wonderful. If anybody has not gone to chanting service on Sundays, it's really wonderful because I do feel a connection to that lineage of ancestors. And that's something I actually, upon reflection, I think I do trust almost without doubt that, you know, these people that came before us in our lineage, our ancestors, are sort of like carefully transmitting something that is genuinely true. And I found that to be a really satisfying kind of like a tangible thing that I can do with my practice. Thank you, Ruth Ann. Aaron, you got a hand up.
Thanks, Mick. So I'm a ongoing fan of Kodo Suwaki, and one of the books that his quotes is Zen Teachings in the Homeless Kodo. And I was actually just going through it the other day. There's chapter 70 leads off with the quote, sort of dealing in as far as the practice in daily life. And I thought that this is actually a good jumping off point. He says, I once saw a play with a character who wondered, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I've never had such bad fortune that I had to ask, what am I going to do? Because I see nothing is worth worrying about. And to me, that's, although difficult to leap onto all the time, I think that is the sort of thing that I have full trust and faith, quote unquote, in as far as the practice. The other thing, and it may sound a little bit weird, is since I really got re-engaged with the practice, no birth, no death, and the notion of the, you know, the delusion of the categories between birth and not birth and death and not death, and seeing actually beginning to sort of change the viewpoint that no birth, it's just a continuous, everything is just this moment and eternally backwards and eternally forwards, if you could even say it like that. That has become a source of real truth and faith for me too, and really has changed sort of my perspective on how I see life in general, how I see the world, how I see things going on around, right? So anyway, that's all. Thanks very much.
Yeah, that was excellent. I'll give everybody else just a minute if anybody else wants to share anything. All right. Let's see.
I think Paulette raised her hand.
Oh, Paulette, I'm sorry. I didn't even, man, wait, what you got, Paulette?
Well, the part that kind of resonates with me, and I don't know if you talked about this before or we talked about this in a previous meeting, but though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. So maybe the idea that there's two ways I look at this, that it could be like our perception kind of colors everything that we do, and in that way it becomes like the way we see things through that lens becomes our reality. And then it also reminds me of William Blake and William Blake's poem to see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. So like kind of what Aaron was talking about with the moment, and I, you know, the more I live in life, my small little life, the more I realize how the moment is really all that matters. And I think that's what I know to be true.
Yeah. That's beautiful. You know, I think that's really interesting that you went, and Aaron as well, to this idea of a moment, including sort of like all of time. I think that's fascinating. So as a math person, what we love to do is we love to take time and like stretch it out on an axis. Basically, like, you know, here on the axis is 2 seconds and here on the axis is 3 seconds. But in the same way that you can always kind of divide space into smaller bits of space, you can divide time into smaller bits of time. And in the same way, you can have a small hut that includes the entire world, you can have a second that includes all of time in it. I think that's wonderful. Thank you. Well, give it another second. I'm going to see if I can. My view is stuck on. Oh, there we go. See if we got any raised hands. The book actually tells me that tense. One thing that weird that I am definitely going to miss. I've probably missed 1,000 of them already. Are these Zen literary references that refer to other things in Buddhism. I think Marv brought one up about pines being representative of the sage. And one of the things that the book has told me, my fancy little book over here has told me, is that 10 feet square is a reference to the Vimalakirti Sutra, which I think Mark pointed out last week, which is excellent. The Vimalakirti Sutra is a Mahayana sutra where this this layman, Vimalakirti, like kind of like shows everybody up. So he's got Buddha and all of his guys and all of these bodhisattvas, and everybody gets shown up by Vimalakirti. It's a really kind of a fun sutra. It's got a bunch of supernatural weirdness in it. But anyways, that's a reference to that. If you want to get on that rabbit hole, we've got lots of references that I'm sure I've missed as well. Okay, so we'll move on in our poem. I'll start sharing my screen again. I gotta go back. There he is. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? I thought this was an interesting line. We hear like middling and lowly a bunch in Zen, which is like not sort of like it's not a great way of phrasing it, but I think what he's referring to here. He also refers to in Sandokai as to whether human faculties are sharp or dull. And we had a really great sort of like discussion about what is meant by faculties on our Thursday night group. But essentially what he was referring to in that part was like whether your capabilities, whether at the root of your humanness, is there lots of potential or not lots of potential in terms of all of these relative classifications? Are you good at this? Are you tall? Are you short? Are you fast? Are you slow? All of these things, and how they don't necessarily matter in an absolute sense. And to me, in these lines, he's talking about middling or lowly in terms of like all the sort of like I guess what he's trying to use an example of like, it doesn't matter if you're sharp or smart or all of these things, and the middling and lowly, those that are sort of focused on the relative view of things, who can't really see it, they can't help wondering whether this hut will perish or not. And I think it's pretty clear to us that if you build a grass hut where there's nothing of value, that hut will perish. It will not last. And so in a literal sense, like very clearly, this is not gonna last. But we wonder if it will perish or not, because what he's talking about is practice. And here we are, you know, 1,000 years after its writing, and we're trying to take this poem, this thing, as guidance for our own practice. And so in some way, the hut has not perished because he's built up a way of practice and that has lasted until now, and it is still giving us these instructions. And I thought that was a really neat set of lines. Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines. Jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. This one's really neat. I like this little stanza. He's sort of talking about, well, in some sense it doesn't matter because the original master is present. What I got from the book is that the Chinese character for original master is also the same Chinese character that's sometimes translated as host, which has a lot of usage in Zen and in Zen texts. And so that's sort of like a loaded phrase that he's built up there. And I think what he's trying to say, imperishable or not, the original master is present. The idea, the mind of the Buddha, the host, is present. It's here, whether the hut is perishable or not. And it doesn't dwell north or south, east or west. We talked, I think, in our Thursday night group about in Shuto's time, there were sort of developing rival schools, China, that sort of had different approaches to the way that Zen might the way that you might achieve enlightenment in Zen, and that there's the Northern school and the Southern school. And I think what he's trying to say here, and in both poems, in the Song of the Grass Hut and the Sandokai, the harmony of difference and sameness, I think he's trying to address, at least tangentially, the dispute between the Northern school and the Southern school, and trying to say, like, look, it's not a matter of, like, Northern school is right and Southern school is wrong. And I think we can see that here. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. Now, this one I thought was really interesting, because he's talking about the basis of his grass hut. And the basis of his grass hut is firm, and it's steadiness and firm. And what I wanted to maybe talk about and open it up to the group and see if anybody, what is something that you feel like you can always come back to in your practice that helps ground you? I remember for a time, I really felt kind of like refreshed when I sat in the morning. I would sit zazen in the morning, and then I felt like my day was a little bit more open and a little bit more, everything felt a little clearer when I went through my day. I would have some challenges, and I read in a book from Norman Fisher, there was a phrase that I would kind of like repeat to myself when I could feel myself getting disoriented, so I would kind of repeat the phrase to myself, and that would help keep me grounded in my practice. It would help keep my practice kind of at the forefront of my daily experience. And I wanted to ask anybody here, we can open it up, is there something that helps keep your practice based on steadiness? Is there something that you routinely do or try to that helps you keep your practice as part of your daily experience? Joan, go ahead.
So I tend to see things in a negative light a lot of the times. And so lately in particular, I've really been trying to, when a negative thought comes up about something or someone, I try to turn it around into a positive thought. That is really pretty powerful for me. It's really helpful. I have to, you know, continue to work at it, because the negative thing has just been so ingrained. But I don't want to be there. Yeah. I don't want to be there anymore. So it's really, it's really worth the effort. And there was another thing that I was going to say. Just remembering that it's just thoughts. All things are just thoughts. And, I didn't say these things to anybody or whatever, you know, they're just in my head. And so treat them lightly.
Yeah, so. I do. It's interesting with the negative thoughts. It's very hard to be gentle with yourself with negative thoughts, right? Because what happens to me, and I feel like this happens with a lot of people, is you have a negative thought and then you go, oh, I shouldn't have. And then you get mad at yourself, which is another negative thought. Yeah. And then you just go down this cycle. It's very difficult to kind of have a negative thought and go, oh, I just had a negative thought. And then just to kind of that is definitely something. Thank you, Joan. Alice, you got a hand up?
Sorry, I got a sticky mouse that won't move the mute button. Yeah, so something that grounds me always is the breath. And of course, everyone always talks about, oh, you gotta think about your breath. You gotta think about your breath. And that does help. But there's also this thing, you know how like, maybe people have heard this where like everything comes to sense when you're almost dying. I don't know whether anyone's had a near-death experience, but I've been badly attacked by a dog. Like mauled. And oh my God, my pits are sweaty. But I remember blood everywhere. Two of my limbs were badly bit into. Bone was sticking out of my thumb. My brother carried me into the SUV in the back, like in the trunk, so that I don't have to bleed on his fabric. And it was a mess, basically. And I just remember not feeling the pain, but just totally focusing on the breath and watching the LA skyline go past as he rushes to the ER. And it's the same thing I go back to when I have a nervous breakdown about something, or, you know, I go through something difficult. If I go back to the breath, seems like everything's just is, you know? So I think that's grounding.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you, Alice. Karen?
Yeah, when I start getting really anxious, it almost always is because I'm ruminating about some concern I have in the future. Not necessarily my future, but usually one of my kids, or even like in the present, what's going on with them, or or in the future. And it really helps me because I usually recognize that I'm doing that. And if I just remind myself that all I really know is what's going on in my little, you know, hula hoop around me at this moment. And, you know, I'm just constructing all these ideas of what, I mean, it's all just ludicrous, except, you know, they're not even with me. I have no idea what they're doing. But, you know, I can really just spin a horrible image of what's going on in their lives. So anyway, it really, really helps me a lot if I just sort of pause, you know, just stop and pause and remind myself that all I know right now is what I can see and what is going on around me. And for me, that really helps a lot. And also, just like Alice was saying, just to focus on my breath. And that helps me a lot when I'm in public someplace, when I start to starting to feel anxious, as I will just listen to my breath or feel it, and it just sort of calms me down.
Yeah, it's interesting how the sensations of the body can always be so grounding. I like to just kind of like subtly put my hands together when I feel like I'm kind of like derailing on one of those thought cycles, and just the kind of, and just really try to focus on the sensation in my little fingertips and stuff. There's so many nerve endings in the hand that I feel like you can get a lot out of just gently placing one hand into the other. I really, it's really nice. But the breathing is wonderful too. I found that like, there's a particular way I can kind of move my spine around to where I get really good posture, and I can kind of feel my breath going all the way in, and it's just, it's magnificent. Give it a second if anybody else wants to share. We are quickly running out of time, and I did want to get to the next line. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. I think those are some beautiful lines. And I think Linda R. Brought those up last time as ones that she really liked. I think it's beautiful. The imagery is wonderful. We're gonna skip past it to the next one though, because I have some stuff that I guess we'll end on in the next stanza. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Rest, ease, and calm are like really common sort of themes in Zen, and so we can see it here again. But the line that sticks out to me, and one of my favorite, I guess, parts about Zen, is this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. And this idea of not knowing and accepting that you don't know was really eye-opening for me as part of my practice. To me, it's so difficult, and I'm not going to claim that I've been able to really do it to any real extent, but to see it as a goal, not a goal, but to see it as something that I can try to do in situations is wonderful. Like I'm a very logical person, and I like to think like, ooh, if I can figure it out, right? Like if I have a chalkboard and a couple of hours, I can figure anything out. I can go and I can write down, and there's going to be some formulas and I can get it. And so for a really long time in my life, everything was like figure out a bowl. Even if I didn't spend the time in figuring it out, like I could. I could figure something out because everything was there to be figured out, was there to be understood. And you know, like you grow up and things start happening and you don't understand them. And it was really difficult to let go. My oldest son, who's adopted, he's adopted from Korea, and I've told this story 1,000 times, and so I'm sorry to everybody. I feel like that's all I ever talk about. But when you adopt from Korea, they give you this packet. It's literally an information packet, and it has all the things about your child before you meet them and before you take custody of them. And so at the time, my son was about 16 months old when we got the packet. So it had like, you know, he lives with his foster family. It tells you about his foster family. You know, his foster dad's a taxi driver, and it's got all this stuff. And it's just pages and pages of medical reports and scans and all the stuff. And at the very end of it, there's a bit where they describe as best they can about the birth parents. And so that part is very short. And what we got for George, who's my oldest, is he was born to a mother in extreme poverty. And she had, when she was pregnant, she had sort of filed the paperwork to give him up for adoption. But then when he was born, she kind of decided that she wanted to try to make it work. And so he lived with her for about 2 months. And they they were unhoused. I think they lived on the street, and I think she, I don't think she provided him with a lot of nutrition. I don't think she could. I don't think she was able to provide him with a lot of attention or kind of develop any of the bonds that a child would need with their mother. And then after about 2 months, she decided that it just wasn't going to work. And so she gave him to the adoption agency, and he lived with a foster family for about a year and a half. And then he came home to our home, and it sort of sense, this is a very long story. He sort of exhibited some, what we call them, trauma-informed behaviors, but he is traumatized by relationships that he has with caregivers, and he reacts in a way that is informed by his trauma. So anyone who tries to kind of care for him, he'll kind of react in a way that's extremely violent. He has these kind of outbursts. And when they first started, I thought, if I could just figure out what really happened in those first 2 months of his life, if I can just figure it out, if I could just know, you know, then I'd be able to fix it. Then I'd be able to kind of work at it, that we could figure him out too. And I think what I love about not understanding is this idea of like, so what? So what if I find out? And so what if I knew? So what if I was there? So what if I know everything about him that doesn't make it any different than the way that it is? And to think about things in terms of being able to understand them leads you to being able to think that people are these like fixed things, and you can repair them and they can be broken. And I think that all of these concepts are sort of like the logical outflow of the way of thinking about existence and the world that we live in terms of something that you can understand. He just is my son, and I am his dad, and there's not anything more or less to it to understand or to not understand. It just is, and I can just be okay with not knowing. If anybody read Waking Up to What You Do, I think Rosetto calls this the dead spot. And I really like the kind of the way that she phrased it, at the dead spot of this, like, I don't know, everything is kind of hinged there, and you do something, and you act on the information that you have or don't have, and you just be there and live in this moment. I think I have run us almost thoroughly out of time. I apologize for that. I don't know if anybody, we've got about 2 minutes, if anybody wants to do a quick share on not knowing or how that might inform their practice.
Could you let us see everybody and take us off screen share?
I sure could. Hold on just a second. Sorry about that. Did that do it? Okay, great. All right, well, it is midnight Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific. So that's going to bring us to a close. I'll go ahead and do our closing verse. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all. This was really wonderful.
It was. Thank you, Mac.
We almost made it halfway through, right? Like,
good night.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Thank you, Mick. Really rich text.
Thank
so
you.
Much, so much there.
I know. It's wonderful.
Appreciate your hard work.
Yeah.
Thank you.